Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In March 1865, the Confederate States of America adopted a measure by which the military would train slaves to fight in the Confederacy's defense. And it stipulated that those who took up arms would be set free. What was the purpose of this measure, which seems to fly in the face of the generally held position that the South fought the Civil War to keep its slaves? And what was its impact on the South? Our guest this week, Bruce Levine, has written a book on the subject, Confederate Emancipation, and he and I will be discussing that book in just a few minutes. After that, Fiona Beattie will let you know where you can find the largest collection of Civil War-related artifacts and documents. And for our weekly commentary, J. Frederick Faust will tell us about the first act of terrorism on American soil. But first, as we do each week, let's look at a couple of related items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed, both related to the Civil War. Just to keep things in perspective, one recent news report reminds us that many more soldiers in the Civil War died of disease than battle-related injuries, and, to be more specific, that many more soldiers were threatened by bedbugs than artillery. Entomologist-turned-historian Gary Miller has found that where 110,000 soldiers died in battle, 200,000 died of disease, and he blames insects for spreading much of the disease. On Friday, July 10, 1863, one soldier wrote to his wife, "The flies are in the millions. They are never off the table, but dead and dying in every mouthful we eat." It's not the stuff of Civil War reenactments, Miller admits, but insects probably did more harm than the traditional weapons of war. Is it distasteful to talk about? "I've yet to have someone say enough already," he responds. "Maybe it's just because everybody knows what it's like to fight a bug." And in another matter not often represented in Civil War reenactments, as revealed in a recent article in History Today, Civil War soldiers continue to suffer from ill health even after the war ended. According to researchers, around 85% of Union Civil War soldiers had various physical and psychological problems long after the fighting ceased. They examined 15,000 records in the archives of general psychiatry and found heart, stomach, and mental health problems affecting the lives of combatants after 1865. Poor health was likely to affect soldiers under 17 compared with those aged over 31. Prisoners of war and those in high-risk regiments also had a greater incidence of ill health later in life. Roxanne Cohen Silver commented, "For the first time, we have objective records indicating that horrific war experiences are associated with a lifetime of increased physical disease and mental health difficulties." Unfortunately, she added, "we know that the deleterious health effects seen in a war conducted more than a century ago are applicable to the health and well-being of soldiers fighting wars as we speak." When we return, I'll be speaking with Bruce Levine about his new book, Confederate Emancipation. This is Talking History. Ever since its defeat in the American Civil War, defenders of the Confederacy have often denied that the goal of secession was to preserve slavery. Instead, they insist that the Confederacy was formed to assert Southern independence, to protect the South against Northern aggression that threatened their way of life.
In support of that position, they point to a proposal put forth in early 1864, although not adopted until March of 1865, that would train the most courageous of Southern slaves, as it was worded, to be soldiers. It further stipulated that every slave in the South who shall remain true to the Confederacy in this war be freed. Our guest this week, Bruce Levine, has studied this proposal and included his findings in a new book on the subject, Confederate Emancipation, Southern Plans to Free and Arm Slaves During the Civil War. Bruce Levine is also a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi, Brian.
So where did this idea come from of arming and emancipating slaves in the Confederacy? Who thought of it and what were the circumstances?
Well, some people proposed it right away. There were a couple of suggestions even before the war got started. And shortly after the beginning of the war, even someone like General Richard Ewell proposed it directly to Jefferson Davis. Other suggestions came early on from residents of the Lower South, where the relative size of the black population was the largest. And basically, what they were trying to do was overcome a problem that the Confederacy had and that virtually everyone in the Confederacy knew they had, which was that the Union enjoyed a huge advantage in military manpower. There were approximately three times as many military-age adult white males in the Union as in the Confederacy.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I don't think any of the readers are going to be surprised. I certainly wasn't, to read that this proposal faced some considerable opposition at first. But they may be surprised, as I was, to see how that conversation changed in time, how the opposition, first of all, reflected the South's values and goals, as well as how they viewed the relationship between slavery and secession. So tell us about that first.
Well, the opposition, of course, initially included the Confederate government itself, as well as most of the leaders of the Confederate Army and the vast majority of the white population of the South. And the opposition included such things as concerns that this would mean sacrificing the whole purpose of the war. What in the world, as R.M.T. Hunter of Virginia asked once the debate really got going, what did we go to war for if not to preserve our property? So wouldn't this be utterly self-defeating to arm and emancipate the very human property for which we're fighting in the first place? And other objections moved out from that to what's going to happen to the plantation system without such slaves, and what will be the whole point of Confederate independence if the social and economic basis of that is gone? And of course, despite the fact that Confederate leaders liked to claim that the slave population was utterly loyal, underneath that claim was the well-grounded fear that the opposite was the case, and that if Southern blacks were given guns, they would either turn them over to the Union Army or indeed turn those guns against the Confederacy itself. And more broadly still, the fear was that if slavery broke down, if black Southerners were emancipated and armed, that would mean the end not only of slavery, but also of white supremacy in general.
Okay, you've been talking in general, and you mentioned one comparatively minor voice in terms of what our listeners are likely to know about the war. But let me ask you about two big names, and were they on the same page, or was there any difference in, say, Confederate President Jefferson Davis's position on this, or General Robert E. Lee?
Well, they were evidently on the same page from the very start. Davis was against the proposal, as I mentioned earlier, when Ewell proposed it to him, and later on when another general in the Army of Tennessee, Patrick Claiborne, proposed it. Davis was dead set against it, as was the whole government. And although after the war, Robert E. Lee claimed that he had been in favor of precisely this proposal from the very beginning of the war, there's no evidence of that. However, later on, they changed their mind, and both of them apparently changed their minds more or less in tandem.
Okay, let's talk about that. What did change their mind, and how would they then reconcile this new policy with their commitment to preserving the South's plantation system, slavery, and white supremacy?
Well, what changed their mind was a combination of military and social developments. After the middle of 1863, it became increasingly apparent that the South, the Confederacy, was losing the war. The fall of Vicksburg lost the Confederacy, finally, the control of the vital Mississippi River. Lee's defeat at Gettysburg was a major setback and a major blow to the biggest army that the Confederacy had in the field. And meantime, manpower levels in the Confederacy and its armies were dropping, and just as important, it was becoming more and more obvious that the black population not only opposed the Confederacy, but was actively supporting the Union. And this, of course, was reinforced by Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which came into effect in the beginning of 1863. By the fall of 1864, it was almost impossible to miss that the Confederacy was losing the war. Slaves were making their way to the Union Army, in many cases joining the Union Army. So slavery was in fact dissolving, as well as was the Confederacy going down to defeat. And at that point, the Confederate government and at least a portion of its military leadership decided to rethink this whole proposition.
Now, at this point, you kind of go in, I think, an interesting direction that caught me off guard. You've been talking about more or less what I would label local or domestic reasons for doing it. But then you mention in your book and spend some time talking about similar situations elsewhere in the world, like in France and Japan. And then you talk about 19th century Central and Eastern Europe. We don't have a lot of time to talk about all these areas, so why don't we just focus on what was going on in Central and Eastern Europe that might have influenced this decision?
Well, it's not clear whether this actually influenced the decision in the Confederacy or simply paralleled it. But what was happening in Europe generally was that an old system of unfree labor on the land, serfdom and variations on serfdom, was also breaking down. From Central Europe eastward, that was increasingly clear. And the rulers in that part of the world were trying to figure out how to salvage what could be salvaged from this crumbling familiar system. And in places like Eastern Germany, Poland, and Russia, the elites began to ask themselves, if we can't hold on to serfdom, and if indeed the danger is present that serfdom will prove a positive weakness in wars with foreign enemies, and indeed that the serfs themselves will rise up against us, how can we come up with a form of emancipation that will nonetheless leave our elites as elites, wealthy and with a source of involuntary labor at their disposal, despite the end of serfdom as we have known it?
Okay. Now, this wasn't implemented until March of 1865. It was only a matter of a couple weeks before Lee surrendered. So we might just say that the impact on the war was negligible, although I'll give you a chance in a few minutes if you want to talk about that a little bit more. But what was its immediate impact, at least on public opinion, or maybe even the attitudes of Confederate soldiers?
Well, the first reaction to Jefferson Davis's proposal along these lines, which does indeed occur, as you said, in the fall of 1864, was a pouring of outrage, especially in the forms of speeches in the Confederate Congress and editorials and letters to the editor in the Southern press. General reaction along the lines that I referred to earlier, which is, well, what has this war been all about? If we emancipate our slaves, what have been we've been fighting for? There was similarly a reaction of demoralization and anger in the army itself, and letters that soldiers sent home expressed that deep dismay at this proposition. As the Confederate war effort continued to deteriorate, that slowly began to change too. In December of 1864, January of 1865, the realization that defeat was on the horizon begins to dispose even some of these people to grit their teeth and recognize that the alternative to adopting some form of such a proposition was utter defeat and forceful reincorporation into the Union. Nonetheless, it's clear that there was widespread demoralization taking place within Robert E. Lee's army, even as some of its soldiers felt themselves obliged to express support for the proposition. But it seems also pretty clear that once the debate moves along and the proposal becomes law, it leads to an increase in desertion, a desertion which is already significantly undermining the strength of that army.
Bruce, as historians, I know that we resist being drawn into what we call counterfactual history or what-if history, but let me ask you nonetheless to give it a shot here. If this plan had been implemented earlier, say as much as a year or two earlier, could it have made a difference?
Well, I think it could. I can't resist saying, however, in answer to the thought you expressed earlier, that despite the fact that racism was endemic throughout the Union as well as the Confederacy, it's significant that the Union, despite opposition, was able to enact a proposal like this at the beginning of 1863 and do it, while the Confederacy never was. As for the long-term effects of adopting this earlier, had the Confederacy been able to do so, well, I like counterfactual history. I think implicit in most of our thinking about what makes history happen and why it happened the way it did is an idea of, well, what if things had happened differently? So I think if the Confederacy had done this, it might very well have turned the tide of the war. If the Confederacy had armed and emancipated large numbers of slaves in 1861 or 1862, I think it's reasonable to suppose that the war could have ended in a Confederate victory, or at least enough of a stalemate so that the Confederacy would have retained its independence and there would have been two countries and landmass that had been and would later, in fact, remain the United States.
Interesting. Okay. Now, this brings us full circle back to where we started, at least with my introduction, that this is very much a part of, and maybe sets the stage for how we remember the war, or the Southerners' memory of the war, what we often refer to as the Lost Cause. Tie this together for us.
Well, the actual proposal reflected a couple of key facts. It was an act of desperation forced upon the Confederacy by the fact of black opposition to slavery, black resistance to slavery, black collaboration with the Union Army, and Union Army successes on the ground. The leaders of the post-war South depicted it as virtually the opposite of that. They depicted it as proof that slavery was not central to the South, not central to the Confederate war effort, that masters were indeed so uninterested in slavery, so ready to do away with it, that they were prepared to sacrifice it for the sake of self-government. They also tried to depict it as proof that slavery itself was benign, that slaves were loyal to their masters, indeed so loyal that they were willing to fight for the Confederacy, and so that instead of depicting it as what it actually was, proof of the breakdown of slavery and the defeat of the Confederacy, post-war Southern historians attempted to depict it as confirmation of everything they had always said about the war and the Confederacy itself. And indeed, the most determined defenders of the Confederacy continue to this day to insist that all that was true.
Absolutely, and it was very much a part of popular culture in the 20th and even as we go into the 21st century. So this at least gives us some historical reference on that. So on that, we're going to close, but I want to thank you, Bruce, for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest this week has been Bruce Levine, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the author of Confederate Emancipation, Southern Plans to Free and Arm Slaves During the Civil War, published by Oxford University Press. This is Talking History.
Oh, roll Alabama, roll. When the Alabama's keel was laid, roll Alabama, roll. 'Twas laid in the yard of Jonathan Laird. Oh, roll Alabama, roll. 'Twas laid in the yard of Jonathan. Roll Alabama, roll. 'Twas laid in the town of Birkenhead. Roll, roll Alabama, roll. Down the Mercy ways she rolled then. Roll Alabama, roll. And Liverpool fitted her with guns and men.
As a follow-up to my conversation with Bruce Levine, Fiona Beatty joins us to tell us about a very large collection of artifacts and documents from the American Civil War.
The Museum of the Confederacy, MOC, claims to maintain the world's most comprehensive collection of artifacts, manuscripts, and photographs from the Confederate States of America. Located in Richmond, Virginia, in the historic Court End neighborhood, 2 blocks from the historic state capitol and Capitol Square, visitors will see a collection running the gamut from decorative art objects, memorial badges, ribbons, souvenirs, flags, weapons, uniforms, and over 5,000 domestic items, including plantation wooden shoes, soap, coverlets, and baskets crafted by slaves. The photograph collection contains over 6,000 original images, including photographs by Matthew Brady, Alexander Gardner, Timothy O'Sullivan, and George N. Barnard. Also in the collection are prints of battlefields and a secondary collection containing 7,000 negatives. At the Eleanor S. Brockenborough Library, researchers will find more than 625 cubic feet of manuscripts, as well as maps, prints, imprints, and 10,000 books and periodicals, and more. If you are interested in the history of the Confederate States of America, this is a must visit. To plan your visit, go to moc.org.
That fatal Friday morning, there fell under the bloody and barbarous hands of that perfidious and inhumane people, contrary to all the laws of God and men, of nature and nations, 347 men, women, and children, and not being content with taking away life alone, they fell again upon the dead, defacing, dragging, and mangling the dead carcasses into many pieces, and carrying some parts away in derision with base and brutish triumph. So wrote Edward Waterhouse in his report on what our guest commentator this week, J. Frederick Faust, identifies as the first act of terrorism in English America. Faust is a professor of history at the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Despite our preoccupation with terrorism, historians have failed to identify its origins in this country. The first terrorist attack against English-speaking civilians in American history occurred in the Jamestown Colony on Friday, March 22, 1622. In a single day, Powhatan Indians slaughtered almost 30% of all the colonists in Virginia, including at least 35 women and 30 children. The killing of noncombatants was an unprecedented departure from traditional Chesapeake-Algonquin warfare. In an earlier English Holy War between 1609 and 1614, however, Virginia colonists had killed indiscriminately Indians of both sexes and all ages. In 1622, the Powhatans used such imported terror tactics in order to preserve their cultural traditions from Christian conquest, targeting unarmed civilians by necessity because the first war had decimated their warrior population. Although the word terrorism was not coined until the 1790s, the 17th century English were very familiar with the terror that accompanied the purposefully random and dehumanizing slaughter by surprise of innocent citizens. In 1622, Londoners immediately grasped the similarities between the Virginia Massacre and the infamous gunpowder plot of 1605. That aborted but traumatic event had helped inspire the founding of Jamestown. The conspiracy by Catholic fanatics to blow up Parliament has been recognized only recently as a terrorist plot in the modern mold. Its intended victims at the time described it as, quote, the quintessence of Satan's policy of inhuman malice and cruelty, not to be paralleled among the savage Turks, the barbarous Indians, or brutish cannibals, end quote. The Virginia Massacre 17 years later produced what John Donne called a flood of blood. That devastating attack in peacetime nearly eradicated Britain's premier colony and gave England its first American martyr, the pious missionary George Thorpe. His murderers were denounced as perfidious, treacherous, savage, wild, and degenerate. which made the Poetans comparable to, but certainly no worse than, Jesuits, gunpowder plotters, and others the English called outlaws of humanity in that age of sacred rage. Ironically, the very colonists who had survived the tragic massacre rejected pleas by London clergymen to exterminate the Poetans in Old Testament fashion. Instead, the Virginians learned to coexist with Indian enemies by forging enlightened alliances with Indian friends. They repudiated both Christian conversion and Christian crusades as equally dysfunctional and dangerous. Their refreshing, non-religious pragmatism preserved multi-ethnic diversity in the Chesapeake, making at least one small part of the English-speaking world revolutionary, exemplary, and truly new.
You've been listening to J. Frederick Faust, professor of history at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and the author of a forthcoming book on the Poetan Uprising of 1622, about which he just spoke. Faust's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. That's it for another week of Talking History. In closing this week's program, I regret to announce that Talking History will suspend its operations after airing next week's show. As you know, Talking History is underwritten by the Organization of American Historians, and the organization is facing some financial challenges that it must meet. To do so, it's making a number of cuts in its expenditures, including its support of Talking History. We hope that this will be a temporary suspension, but in the meantime, you can check on our future plans and access several years of programs at oah.org. As always, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian Laveau. Thank you.